Crossing into Wales slowly lifting, sunshine developing in most places, but a breezier day for Scotland and Northern Ireland, much more cloud here, and once again we could see some rain or drizzle in the northwest of Scotland.
Many thanks, Darren Bett. Now on BBC Radio 4, our Book of the Week. And Gideon Lewis Krauss reports back on the second of his three pilgrimages, which aims to shake him out of his current inertia and lack of purpose. He's wary of yet another guidebook, and also holds memories of thwarted love in A Sense of Direction.
The pilgrimage which now gripped my imagination was the 88 temples of Shikaku. Like the Camino, the O'Henro, as it's ordinarily called, dated back about 1,000 years, but it only recently experienced a surge in popularity. Like the Camino, it was nominally religious, but was now taken up in a largely secular mode. And like the Camino, the path was fashioned after a compelling historical itinerant. Kukai, or Kobo Daishi, the St. James of Shikoku, is one of the most revered figures in Japanese history. He was born into minor nobility in northern Shikoku in 774, near Temple 75, Sensuji, and in the early 9th century brought Shingon, or esoteric Buddhism, from China to Japan, where he became renowned as a holy man, scholar, calligrapher, and engineer. The idea of the pilgrimage is that it's a tour of the places where Kukai practiced austerities on his path to enlightenment, which he achieved at the precocious age of 19 in a cave beneath Temple 24. Unlike the Camino, though, the O'Henro is a circle, not a line. Expectations must be different, I thought. You end where you began, back at Temple 1, T1. The experience is one of both straying and returning. Shikoku is the most rural and the least populated of Japan's four main islands, and is idealized as a connection to Japan's mythic pre-industrial past. It is both a sacred place, a different place, as well as a place that's traditional and familiar in its otherness. On the day I made my decision, I called my brother Micah, whose Shanghai apartment was a vast corporate sky palace. "How is your extra bedroom? How long are you coming for? I arrive December 15th. You bought a ticket already? Maybe. My boat for Japan leaves at the end of February, so I can start the temple circuit on the 1st of March. In Shanghai, I encountered yet another unavailable woman, a friend of friends, and was instantly smitten. On a Tuesday evening, I met her for one drink at Ying Yang, and by the time we'd finished the red pack of double happiness cigarettes on the wooden table in front of us, I was ready to follow her anywhere. By which I mostly mean I was ready for her to follow me anywhere. She took me to see her favorite Filipina cover band in the revolving restaurant bar at the top of the Radisson Hotel, overlooking People's Park. We leaned back into the couches and peered up through the glass dome to where some stars should have been. I wanted to spend the rest of my life watching her tuck her hair behind her ear. "Come with me on this last silly jaunt," I said, "and then let's find a place to be still together." Needless to say, she said no. I managed to arrange company for the first 5 days of my second walk. Max, my dad's father, had just turned 82 and wanted once more to see Japan, where he'd traveled frequently on business before he retired as an engineer. Max is the busiest retiree anybody has ever heard of, so he could accompany me only as far as T11. And then from T12 to T88, I'd be on my own. He met me at the boat from Shanghai, and we took a bus to Tokushima, one of Shikoku's three cities, where we met David Morton, the John Brearley of the 88 Temples, who picked us up and drove us to T1. Morton and I had emailed when I ordered his guidebook, and he'd kindly offered us an initial lift. Morton takes us around the pilgrim shop at T1, Ryo Zenji. He helps us overpay for the little name slips one leaves at the worship halls and gives out as a receipt for osetai, gifts to pilgrims. Our calligraphy books for the proof of temple visit stamps, our matching white vests that Mr. Pilgrims wear, with a line from the Heart Sutra inked on the back, some matching felty eggshell boating caps, and, finally, our walking sticks. Morton suggests we get going. It's late in the day and he's booked us a room in a ryokan, a traditional Japanese inn down the road near T3. We hurry off, glad to be underway at last. The route from T1 to T2 runs along a muddy shoulder behind a guardrail, past some auto body shops and a few dozen convenience stores. It's the 1st of March and feels wintry still. The path from one temple to the next is marked with discreet red pointer stickers and hand-carved marble bollards, some of which date back centuries. It feels nicely familiar to fall into the old rhythm of just following the arrows. The houses we pass are a bland assortment of off-white stacked boxes. "Well, I'm sure it'll be nicer when you get into the mountains," Max says, always the careful optimist. These first 10 temples are close together, running in a row up the Yoshino River. We stop at the main gate of T2, which is festooned with heavy coils of rough rope, symbols of the simple sandals Kobo Daishi wore in his ascetic wanderings. On each side of the gate is a large, belligerent sub-deity held in a cage. These flaming gargantuas are supposed to scare visitors into dutiful practice. We bow, as we've been instructed, and enter the courtyard. We arrive at the ryokan, and the proprietress pantomimes the slipper protocol and shows us to our room, a low-ceilinged space with a shallow basin behind a rice paper screen. She shows us to the tiled bath. We take turns sitting at the stool and washing with a bucket in the traditional Japanese style, then soaking in the tub. I come back from the bath, and Max has already donned the traditional yukata, the light cotton evening robe they've put out for us. And together we roll out our futons on the tatami mats. At 6:30, the proprietress fetches us for dinner. An old woman stoops to set 14 tiny courses in front of us, each one intricate and fragile in its own lacquerware dish. Max peers down at what looks like a raw quail egg, shrugs, and pours it over his rice. "Obviously, it's a great adventure, but there are other adventures, so why pilgrimages?" "It's not just an adventure, it's a commitment." He nods, but he's never been somebody lacking in a sense of direction. It's the custom of the island to grant an orange or a liter of water to pilgrims. Max is as thrilled as I am when we get our first osetai. Two heavy, dark, and pendulous apples an older couple give us out of the back of a van near T4. The proprietor of our second ryokan drives us over to the nearby onsen, a traditional Japanese hot spring. Max and I float around in the hot pools and talk about the cross-country ski marches he took us on as kids. I tell him about the girl in Shanghai. I can't stop thinking about her. Afterward, we put on our robes and drink beers over another 17-course meal, and I even get him to gripe about Morton with me. We've allegedly discovered we could have kitted ourselves out for half what we'd paid where he took us. "Yeah, I don't know about that guy," Max says, which is pretty much the worst thing Max will say about anyone. At the train station, Max and I say goodbye and hug for a long time. T12, Shosanji, is atop the second highest mountain of the circuit. The book says it's the first of the 8 Henro Karagashi, literally, "When a Pilgrim Falls Down." The path runs at a harsh slant through beds of scruffy fern, bamboo columns, and towering Japanese cedars. This difficulty is actually welcome. It makes it easier to stop thinking of Max's departure. The path along the ridge is narrow, an elevated walkway high above a forest floor, littered with pine needles and ribbons of the first real sunlight I've seen in Japan. It's steady for a kilometer before it climbs towards the first peak, where some deteriorating concrete steps lead to a massive Kobo Daishi statue. Dark iron blooming in rashes of mint green, a heavy sedge hat and rope sandals, and a stony expression. Now the path drops 300 or 400 meters over a series of mossy switchbacks that lead to a clearing with a rest hut. A young woman sits there waiting for her mother's slow descent, and I give her my last orange. In exchange, she gives me a white Osama Fuda, which means this is her first pilgrimage, too. In a small town below the next ridge, an old man invites me to sit in the street and have tea and a coconut biscuit. He asks if I'm going to stay in town, but I figure lodging will take care of itself later. Within 20 minutes of leaving town, I'm lost. The Morton has switched to a different scale, and by the time I make my descent from T12 to the valley floor, I've been walking for 9 hours. It starts to rain, and I find myself cowering along a guardrail, a river far below on the ravine floor to one side, and speeding cars on the other. At last, I come to an intersection with a convenience store. It's closing, but they've still got a few cold potato croquettes, which I eat, sitting on the curb while I consider my options. Now that Max is gone, I've sworn I'll sleep outside, in one of the huts Morton mentions in the book. I spend an hour wandering around in the dark, looking for a hut marked on the map, but I can't find it. At last, I give in and decide to sleep in a hotel. In the morning, the hotel owner says I should shoot to cover T13, the next temple, through T18, about 25 kilometers, which is what most people achieve from here. For the next 8 hours, I navigate the rundown snarl of Tokushima's dreary suburbs, looking for the series of unremarkable teen temples. The rain doesn't let up all day, and my feet are throbbing. 4 kilometers short of T18, there's a hut whose red banner has the ubiquitous characters for pilgrim. As I'm fluffing my sleeping bag, a man of about 70 jumps off an overloaded bike and joins me in the hut. From what I can tell, he's saying that he's done the entire circuit on foot and on his bike 55 times. I've read about guys like this, perpetual pilgrims living off a sedai. There's even a Japanese word, shikaku sick, for such pilgrimage addicts. Before he hops back on his bike, he hands me 4 cigarettes as a sedai. I wrap my arms around myself as I drift in and out of sleep and wonder what the girl in Shanghai is doing right now.
Patrick Kennedy was reading from A Sense of Direction by Gideon Lewis Krauss. The producer was Duncan Minchul. And you can hear the next episode tomorrow evening at the same time. Now, sailing by, ahead of the shipping forecast. Now on BBC Radio 4, the shipping forecast issued by the Met Office on behalf of the Maritime and Coast Guard Agency at 0015 on Thursday the 13th of March. There are warnings of gales in Hebrides, Bailey, Fair Isle, Faroes and Southeast Iceland. The general synopsis at 1800. Low Iceland 994, expected west of northern Norway 965 by 1800 Thursday. High Southeast Ireland 1032, expected Irish Sea 1030 by same time. The area forecasts for the next 24 hours. Viking north of Sahara, southerly veering westerly 4 or 5, occasionally 6 in north, occasional rain, good, occasionally poor. South of Sahara, variable 3 becoming northwesterly 4 or 5, occasional rain, good, occasionally poor. Forties, Cromarty 4th, southwest.